Welcome to Cat Chat, the pet talk podcast devoted to the physical and emotional well-being of cats and their people. I'm Tracy Hotchner, the author of The Cat Bible, Everything Your Cat Expects You to Know. My mission is to entertain, educate, and inspire cat lovers like you to give kitty cats the best possible life in nutrition, affection, and environmental enrichment. This show is brought to you by Dr. Elsie's, where they speak for cats, which is what this program is all about. My co-host is the feline expert, Dr. Michael Maria Delgado, along with other cat authors and experts. The show is made possible with the generous support of Dr. Elsie's, a company privately owned by Dr. Bruce Elsie, a feline-only veterinarian whose mission has been to personally formulate a wide variety of litters for all types of cats so they keep using their litter box, which keeps them in their loving homes. Dr. Elsie also created his own cat food called Clean Protein, wet and dry foods that are specifically appropriate for a cat's nutrition needs because they're based on the protein a cat eats naturally. Clean Protein is the first dry cat food I personally can recommend because it is based on the protein found in a cat's natural prey. Please show your appreciation that Dr. Elsie's underwrites this show by choosing their products whenever you can. What an incredible book has emerged from the lore of cats. A new book by Sarah Brown, The Hidden Language of Cats, How They Have Us at Meow. For me, really changed the whole way that I looked at cats, and I have a strong feeling it will do the same both for academics and for people living with their cats. This is how Sarah Brown got her doctorate on the social behavior of neutered domestic cats, and the story of it, which is in her book, for me, was just absolutely riveting. Sarah, welcome to the show. Congratulations on a life well lived in terms of cats. You have really devoted yourself with such scholarly love. It's very impressive.
Oh, thank you so much. And hi, Tracy. Thank you for inviting me on.
Well, how could I not? So there's the title, The Hidden Language of Cats, How They Have Us at Meow. And so I don't know what I was expecting. You know, there have been a lot of very charming books. You know, people look at their whiskers and their tails and their body shape, and that means what they're thinking. But you really mean meow. And I guess the most astounding thing that comes out of the book is that the meow, as we think of it and we know it, was developed by cats for human interaction. It's not a cat sound. So we'll roll back the tape a little bit and talk about how you came to what, to me, is the most extraordinary discovery in your work and in the book, although there are many. And I think that must have been a pretty big wow moment for anybody following your work, yes?
Well, yes, I think because I was obviously doing my work quite a long time ago, back in the late 80s, I was probably one of the first people to talk about, you know, what cats are actually doing on a day-to-day basis and trying to analyze that behavior. So I found in my colonies of cats, and I was studying cats, rural feral cats in England, that although I was recording many, many behaviors over many, many hours, I never heard them meow to each other.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible. And then you talk about the mews and the little sounds that the kittens will make to their mom.
Yes, or maybe they do, even to their mom.
For the mom to the kittens, but it's not the same as the meow we think of. What astounded me, and I was aware of your work, is that I didn't understand that you had been, if you will, the Jane Goodall of cats. Because when Jane Goodall went to live with the chimpanzees and everybody mocked her, she's just a young girl, you know, female with an interest in primates, they said, oh, that's absurd. But she lived with them in order to really observe them and see how they lived with each other and found out that they were violent and that they used tools and all the things that would never have been known otherwise. I think what you did was so similar. If I understood it well, these colonies of cats were rehomed to a rural farm or barnyard because they'd been in cities where it didn't work out, particularly for Ginger, or I guess Ginger did better than most. And you went there to study them in that same way of sitting quietly, being an ethologist, and watching. Was that the first time and maybe even the only time that anyone has devoted that amount of time to truly feral cats and then been able to put them in a location where they could be watched in all their genuine feral catness?
Well, it's very nice of you to compare me to Jane Goodall, but
I mean it.
I really don't think that I'm anywhere in her realm, because she's just an amazing researcher. But I think I wasn't the first to study feral cats by any means, because people before me had studied intact breeding colonies of cats, farm cats. And farm cats and cats in colonies around dockyards. And I wanted to look at particularly at neutered colonies to see whether they still had a social structure without that whole mother-kitten breeding, you know, sort of central mother maternal center to things. And so my aim was to look at neutered colonies. So one of my colonies we did rescue from the grounds of a school, and they were neutered, and we relocated them on a farm, and I spent many hours watching them. And then the other colony was already neutered and lived in the grounds of a hospital.
Right, a psychiatric hospital.
That's right, yes. So it was a huge rambling building, you know, in the middle of nowhere, and I would drive up and sit in the grounds, and I chose one particular group that you know seemed quite stable, and I sat and watched them for many hours, but probably not quite as many hours as Jane Goodall.
and maybe better conditions, because you could still have a cup of tea
exactly,
in between, yes. Whereas she was whatever it is that you drink in the bush or in the mountains or wherever it was, not so much a nice, hot, steaming cup of tea.
I don't think I was in quite so much danger ever either.
Right, but I mean, that's I don't know whether she was younger than you were at the time that you were doing your work, but I'd say that being on the grounds of an active psychiatric hospital has a certain element of risk to it. I'm teasing,
maybe.
but it's certainly the way you depicted that hospital and the nooks and the crannies and the basements and the deserted areas. These cats were living very wild.
Yes, they were. And yet at the same time, not so wild, because,
right,
you know, you would see those windows open and food come out from inside the building, and they were right there. You know, they didn't interact with anybody, but they knew, you know, what they needed and what they could get from the people inside the building. And they were clever cats.
And one of the caretakers, I think, had a sense of some were friendly, and I think would even come up to a car or to certain people, right?
That's right, yes, because some of them have been there a lot longer. Some of the cats have been there for years, and then there were some newer ones that regularly people dumped their cats there. So some of the cats there were quite new and were just used to coming up to people as domestic cats would. And these weren't the ones I studied, but they were just like friendly, normal cats.
The fact that the very fact of your title of meow, the very fact that the meow was developed for use with humans, indicating that although everyone's always said cats just live, you know, independently of us and kind of take advantage of the fact that we'll feed them or house them, but in the end, they really don't, they haven't made that dog-like connection to us. Seems to me that what you learned belies that there is an adaptation of domestic cats to human interaction in a way that has to do with communication. And we haven't been listening because we didn't understand, I think.
I think, and that's sort of part of the reason for my book, is
yes,
that I think we just need to listen and look and watch our cats a bit more. And, you know, they do communicate an awful lot. They've got a lot to say for themselves, but they have a different style of communication. We're very vocal. They came from, you know, ancestors that lived by scent, and they've learned to use some of the methods that we use, you know, vocalizations in particular. They've, you know, all these meows, they work on people, and
yes,
well, you know, let's use them a bit more, and let's change them so they sound like a baby's cry, and then people find it really hard to ignore them. But this kind of stuff, I think, is just fascinating.
I do too. And the way you look at it, and the way you studied it, and the way you put, you go from A to B to like Q is really interesting, because because your mind is already there. You have such respect for the cats. You have such acknowledgement of their, you know, for lack of a less stupid word, personhood, that they are individuals, and they are responding to the environment. And even to us, and for some of them, it isn't just food. It could be the socialization, the spend a little time, have a little rub, have a little scritch. There's things
Absolutely.
That matter to
yeah.
them, and some of them more than others. And It's so easy for humans to say, well, I don't know, I can't really see what they're saying or what they really want, so they don't really care, that we dismiss them. We, as a species, we dismiss them because we don't have the patience that you have to sit and watch and draw conclusions about the depth of who they are.
Yeah, I think this is what I want to encourage people to do, is to sit, watch their cats.
Yes.
Think about what they're trying to say and how can you use that to interact with them better, you know, to get more out of your interactions with the cats you meet, and respect it when they don't want to interact in particular.
Yes, and not take it personally or judge them as being a cranky cat or an unfriendly cat.
Yeah, you know, we all have days we don't want to chat, so do they.
Yeah, definitely. Did you have personal cats at the time? I don't remember noticing whether at the time that you were spending these many, many hours watching and writing your doctorate. Did you have cats at that time?
Yeah, I have. I got my first cat when I was doing my studies.
Okay.
That was Tigger.
Right.
He's in the book.
Right.
And then I've had cats pretty much ever since. He lasted. I had him for 19 years. And then...
Well done.
But as I wrote my book, I had Bootsy and Smudge.
Yes.
Who also feature in the book. And they
do.
Kept me good company whilst I wrote and gave me chance to, you know, to watch cats a bit more as I wrote.
But how did it change what you saw in them? Very tame, very neutered, very homebound, attached to you cats. How did it change your perception of them, if it did?
I think poor cats, I probably analyze them endlessly, which is probably, you know, a bit stressful.
They don't know. Them, it's all right. They don't know.
No, I know. I thought perhaps the thing that I used most on them was looking at their personalities, which is a whole chapter of the book.
Yes.
And I found that really interesting to look at my two cats who were sisters, you know, from the same litter, and just be amazed at how different they are in their personalities, you know, how they interact with people differently, how they interact with other animals differently. And I just found that's what I focused on mainly with those two.
And that's why I brought it up, because, of course, I knew that you'd written that chapter. I just wanted people to understand that it isn't just the cats in the wild that you studied and learned from and about. It's that you brought it home and had it affect and influence your relationship with your own cats and even understand maybe theirs with each other. And I think that's one of the ancillary values of the book. Of course, it is the end goal that we all have in the pet field is for people to be the best possible companions to their animals that they can, and vice versa, right?
Absolutely.
And so, but we have to take more responsibility, not just with cats, with dogs as well, but in particular with cats, for what that relationship feels like and looks like. It's not just something that happens and we just, you know, take it or leave it. I think that your book, The Hidden Language of Cats, really helps us understand that we're an active participant unless we choose not to be, in which case we're not holding up our end of the bargain, in a sense.
Well, yes, I agree. I think in some ways I think cats work a lot harder at the relationships that they have with their people than we do.
Yes.
In terms of trying to communicate, and we don't always notice, we just glance.
At best, yeah. Or we act irritated. So, you know, it's sort of like that child that you'll see with a distracted parent going, "Mommy, Mommy, Mommy!" And then the kid has a complete meltdown and is screaming, and the parent thinks, "Oh, what an annoying child." Well, if you would just acknowledge the first mum, just said, "Yes, just a moment, darling," or, you know, given them a toy or something, then they would have felt seen and acknowledged. And I sometimes think some cats have given up on some of us because they've tried to say hello, 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 and we're not noticing because we're a bit blind to it and a bit too wrapped up in our own human life. And on some level, they might just give up.
Yeah, and some do.
Yeah, and you can't really blame them for that. I wonder what you think about the very, very highly bred cats, like the Siamese, the Abyssinians, the much chattier cats, for whom meow is what they do from morning till night, some of them. Now, is that do you think, genetic? Is it learned? Is it because when people seek out those Asian breeds, they want a chattier cat? So the people who adopt or buy them want to have more interaction verbally with them?
Possibly. I mean, they do definitely have a reputation for being more vocal, and that's not a new thing. That's been around for a long time. So that's been, you know, bred into them more and more, I think, as time's gone on. And there is some research to show that, you know, a lot of the personality features of cats, you know, these breeds is related to their actual breed. So, you know, some are much more vocal, and then it's always breed specific. There's definitely an element of, well, yeah, my Siamese is very chatty, and that's why I love him. Why not?
Exactly. But it's the sort of the opposite of people not paying attention to the smallest meow or the smallest attempt to interact. It's the constant chat. I mean, I have a dentist who does that. It's the strangest thing. I guess she thinks you're a captive audience. She just never stops talking. And you can't talk back. And I sort of sometimes think of Siamese that way. Talk back or don't talk back, they're still going to talk to you. So
yeah, you definitely have to enjoy it to be able to,
And then, of course, you know, elicit it. And there isn't an off button, because that's not how it works. So you're just in for the long chat. And if you keep them healthy and alive as long as you did Tigger, then it's a long time. It's going to get really quiet when they're gone, sort of surprisingly. So is there any other signal other than the meow, just in kind of wrapping up? We just have another minute. Is there one other thing that you noticed in terms of their interaction with us or each other that we should just be alert for?
Well, obviously my favorite one, which you'll see from the book, is tail up, which is one of the things I studied in great detail in my colonies, and that signal is very much a friendly intent type signal between cats, and they use it towards us as well. Obviously, they seem to use all their signals towards us, and I found that interactions where cats put their tail up very rarely ended in aggressive or unfriendly behaviour, whereas those that did have their tail up were always rubbing, you know, affectionate.
Yes. So the takeaway from the conversation about the hidden language of cats, how they have us at meow, is if your cat's tail is straight up, it's like putting their hand out for a handshake. Make sure you meet them halfway somehow or other. Sarah Brown, you've written a wonderful book, and it's a great addition to the literature, but also to each person's home and the kitties that they live with. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. I also want to thank Wonderside, founded by a woman entrepreneur who discovered effective natural ways to repel fleas, ticks, and other pests on her pets and around her home instead of putting toxic chemicals in or on them. Wonderside makes plant-powered products to keep parasites at bay without the harsh chemicals that can be harmful to your cats, your property, and the planet. This show is also supported by the privately developed Magic Fabric Pet Throws that trap hair, dirt, and moisture when cats get up on the furniture, bed, or your lap. Magic Fabric Pet Throws invite kitty cuddle time without sacrificing your clothes or furniture. A final pause up to Dr. Elsie's again for all the fine products they make and their unwavering support of my mission to make life better for each and every kitty cat and their people.